Good morning. Good morning. I want to start. I've got two concerns and a joy. My first concern is I didn't win the $1 billion lottery. My joy is I didn't buy a ticket. So I didn't waste any money on that. My second concern is, and this is serious, there's no Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Israel. I mean, I looked it up. I couldn't find one. If any place needs you, it's them. And I want to explore why. To do that, I want to make a distinction between religion and religiosity. Religiosity is the innate human capacity, need maybe, for meaning. And one of the most powerful ways that you and I make meaning is through story. Religiosity is a celebration of story. It's a celebration of the universality of story. And it's a celebration of the human capacity to find meaning in stories that you didn't write. Religion is the mistaking of story as history. When you go to Israel, which I just did, I came back on Tuesday, last Tuesday. When you go to Israel, you find a land steeped in story as history. All the problems, even the political ones, though I'm not going to talk about those, all the problems stem from taking their story as history, whether we're talking about Jews, Christians, or Muslims. The group that I led was sponsored by Spirituality and Health magazine. It was part of their 20th anniversary. And they came up with this idea of sending me to Israel, which sounded like fun a year before I went. But when I actually did it, I wouldn't recommend leading a group anywhere, but certainly not to Israel. And the idea that ours was supposed to be an interfaith journey, a pilgrimage, we would see the sites, you know, like all the other tourists do, but we had meditation and contemplative practices and readings from my book, The World Wisdom Bible, at each site. That stuff worked really well. And I co-taught all that with Gordon Pierman, the Episcopal priest from Nashville. So he and I went together. But what we ran into, both with the group that we were leading and the place that we were leading them, is this inability to take your story as story and this addiction to story as history. So one of the first places we went, I'm not going to do this actually in chronological order, because Jerusalem was like the hotbed of our most conflicted time. So we are in Jerusalem. I don't know if anyone's visited, but there's the Dome of the Rock. That's the iconic gold dome on what's called the Temple Mount, what the Jews call the Temple Mount. That's where Solomon's Temple was and Herod's Temple was, and that was destroyed in 70 CE in the Common Era. And then centuries later, a mosque was built on the site. It's a gorgeous mosque. It's one of the most holy, beautiful spaces in Israel, certainly, maybe on the planet. But you're not allowed to go there. Right? So Jews, there's a big sign from the rabbinic establishment, Jews can't go there because you might inadvertently step on the place where the sacrifices were done. So, and you're not supposed to be able to do that. Only priests can do that. One guy who was in our group, his name was Frank Levy. If your name is Levy or Levitt or Levi or Cohen or Cain or Khan, you're probably descendant of the priests, and you could be up there. Other than him, the rest of us were not allowed. We went anyway. Then there's the Muslim establishment, and they've got these guards all around to protect the purity of the place. Now, ours was an interfaith gathering. There were supposed to be Jews, Muslims, and Christians. The Muslim family had to back out. The guy got a new job, and they couldn't get the time off. So it's just a group of Jews and Christians, mostly Christians. And we're on the Temple Mount, but everybody is, I mean, none of them admitted it, but they're all sort of Unitarian-esque, right? They were open to all this stuff. And there was one woman who was so moved by being there that she just wanted to offer a prayer silently, because to get up there, you had to remove any sign of your religious affiliation. No crosses, no stars, no yarmulkes, nothing. You had to look completely vanilla and not be associated with any religion, including Islam, because they didn't believe you anyway. So she just had this, I just want to pray for peace. And she asked our guide, who was a Palestinian Christian, and she said, can I just go and touch the tile of the building and say something? Now, we were looking at all these other Muslims who were touching the building. It didn't look like there was a problem. As long as they had Purell afterwards, I think you'd be fine. So the guy said, sure, go and do it. Just don't say anything out loud. So this woman, dressed very modestly, you know, you're covered from head to toe, she just walked over, and she was going to place her hand on the wall, not the western wall, we'll get there in a minute, but on the wall of the Dome of the Rock, beautiful tiled wall, and just close her eyes and offer a prayer. Before she could even close her eyes, the, I don't know what you want to call it, the dome police accosted her, took her away. And if it wasn't for the skill of our, you know, native Arab-speaking guide, we probably never would have seen her again. I mean, she's probably going to end up in the Saudi embassy in Turkey. So it was really frightening. But he convinced them that she meant no harm. Now, these guards weren't anti-prayer, and they weren't anti-religion. They just couldn't imagine. They were there to protect the purity of their story. And that meant not letting anyone else who might not share their story as history, because they thought it was history, not let anyone who didn't share that history defile their sacred space by even touching it. Now, I've been in similar situations in mosques in Israel before. In fact, part of our trip was to go visit mosques. None of them would let us in. But this is years ago, I had this desire to pray at every holy site I could get to in Israel on my own. And I went into not the Dome of the Rock, but I went into the adjacent mosque on the Temple Mount called the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's huge. And I walked in, and in those days you could go inside, and I just found a quiet corner, and I sat down, and I was just going to meditate. You know, just the way Frank tells us to do it. And I was thrown out. They wouldn't even let you sit down. So it's all about misunderstanding the true nature of spirituality and mistaking religion for religiosity. So that's the first place, one of the places that this is so clear. We moved on to the garden tomb. So there's, because it's story and not history, though everyone claims their story is history, Jesus was crucified and buried and resurrected in two different places in the same city, depending on what your religion is. So if you're an Orthodox Christian or a Catholic, you believe that Jesus was crucified and then buried in what's now the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, another amazing structure in Jerusalem. And we went to visit that because it's just this amazingly powerful place. I'm not a Christian. I don't believe that Jesus was resurrected. But I do see, you don't have to believe it, I see thousands of people coming in, row, you know, after row after row. And when you first walk into the church, there is a slab, a stone slab on the ground. You have to climb up to where Jesus was crucified. And then, according to the story, they took him down and laid him on this stone slab where they prepared him for burial. And the burial is somewhere else in the building, the tomb where Jesus was buried, Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. Thousands of people every day go to this slab, and they're weeping, and they're touching it. And according to the tradition, though I didn't notice it, but according to the tradition, the stone is always wet. It's weeping itself. The stone itself weeps. And you see people coming with these white claws, and they're wiping the water off the stone and taking it as a relic, and then the stone keeps weeping. There were people in our group who were afraid to touch it, which, again, makes no sense to me. But they weren't Catholic. They weren't Orthodox. They thought something bad would happen to them if they touched the talisman of the Catholic. And that wasn't just true of them. That's true of Protestantism in general in Israel. So after you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you got to go to the Garden Tomb. the opposing tomb, the alternative tomb. If you don't like this crucifixion and resurrection, don't worry, we've got another one. So the Garden Tomb is run by the Anglican Church. It's somewhat like a cult. You go there, and you have everything is like by times. You have to have a certain time slot. You go there, and your guide cannot lead you. You have to have an official guide from the Garden Tomb community. They're all Anglicans. They're not necessarily priests, but they're all Anglicans. They all live on the property. It's very cult-like, it seemed to me. Anyway, this guy was a very nice Irish guy, seemed to be, before he opened his mouth, and took our group and set us down and gave us what's a canned speech. I've heard it before, and you can hear other guides doing it in different parts of the garden. So he starts out, and he tells you that he's Irish, and he's just happy to be here with you and glad that you're there. And then he says that the most important thing for him about being here is that he was born Catholic, but he discovered when he married his Anglican wife that his religion had been the false faith. The Catholicism was false, and the true faith was Anglican Christianity. So our group is mixed. I mean, there's Jews, there's Catholics, there's Protestants, but I didn't want to start something, so I didn't say anything. So then he's talking, and then he comes up with another great line. And that is, he says, as I'm going to be talking to you, we're probably going to be interrupted by the noise coming from the mosques. And he's talking about Adhan, the call to prayer. You know, Allahu Akbar, you know, that thing. And he says, when that happens, when that noise, he kept calling it, that noise happens, we're going to drown it out by singing Christian hymns. At that point, I lost it. And so I interrupted him, and I said, you know, I just want you to know that this is an interfaith group. Some of us are Catholics. You've insulted them. Some of us are Jews. We're waiting to be insulted. But none of us think of the call to prayer from a mosque as noise. We think of it as a sublime call to remember that everything is a manifestation of Allah or nature or reality or however you want to understand it. But it's not noise. So he said, well, it is to me. And I said, well, I could help you with that. But he was not interested. So he went off to take our group around and eventually go to the tomb. I was too pissed to continue because I knew I was just going to, my ego is going to get in the way of everyone else's experience, and I'd be constantly interrupting him. So I went and found a quiet, empty spot in the garden, and I just sat and I meditated. And just like the guy said, the call to prayer came from the mosque, and I love that sound. I mean, if you're in Israel, it happens almost everywhere you go. Unfortunately, it happens at, you know, in the middle of the night. And you go, oh, my God. But I love that sound. I open the windows. I stand on the porch. I listen to it whenever I hear it. So it's wafting over from the various mosques into the Garden Tomb. And to their credit, I didn't hear anybody singing Onward Christian Soldiers or anything like that. So I just, you know, was doing my meditation, and I switched from whatever I was doing for my mantra. I switched over to La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God, which is the central teaching of Islam. And I'm doing that as a mantra, and I'm like in a state of reverie. The sound coming from the mosques, and I'm doing this thing, and in the Garden Tomb, it couldn't get any better. So it got worse. So I'm sitting there, and I'm meditating, and all of a sudden, I hear, are you the rabbi? I said, whoa. I pop out, and I think, I said, yeah, I'm the rabbi. And I was feeling like, whoa, this sounds very Jesus-y, you know, like, are you the rabbi? And there's the tomb, and I'm like, oh, no, the second Jew to get buried in that rock. So at least the first guy got resurrected. I don't have that plan. So I said, yeah, and it was another Anglican guide. And she says to me, when Jesus says he's the Lord, you only have three choices. Either you believe he's lying, or you believe he's a lunatic, or you have to believe, in fact, he's Lord. So that's called C.S. Lewis's trilemma. in the 40s, C.S. Lewis. I don't think he invented it, but he made it famous by putting it on the radio and in one of his radio talks during World War II and writing about it in books. The problem with the trilemma is there's only three choices. Why limit yourself to liar, lunatic, or Lord? So this woman says to me, well, those are your three choices, liar, lunatic, or Lord. Which one do you believe in? And I said, I reject the premise of your question. And you can see she was shocked. Like, what does that mean? So she said, she asked me, so what do you mean? And I said, there's a fourth option. She was startled, but curious. She wasn't angry or anything. She says, okay, what's the fourth option? I said, well, Jesus could have been a self-realized Jewish mystic. And he would have known what all mystics know, that I and God, or I and the Father, or I and the Mother, or I and reality are one. I said, when Jesus says that, he's saying what the Chandogya Upanishad from India says when it says, Tat Tvam Asi, thou art that. Or he's saying what Mansur al-Halaj said, the Sufi mystic said, when he said, I am truth. Or he's saying what Abraham Abulafia says in the 1500s when he says, behold, I am God and God is me. Or he's saying what Meister Eckhart says when he says, the eye with which I see God is the eye with which God sees me. One eye, one seeing, one knowing, one love. So she's like... and she's just, she has nothing to say. So she walks away. And as she's walking away, she says... thank you for that. I'm going to think about it. And in my head, I thought, good, think about it over and over and over again. And maybe you'll get it too. Like, you'll be able to say, I and I and God are one. The problems that the Muslims and the Christians were having, I'll come to the Jews in a second, was that they were taking their story as history and claiming it as uniquely theirs. It was parochial history. It just belonged to them. And you can't question it. You can't challenge it. And they don't want you involved in it unless you're going to become part of it. You can go to the Western Wall in Jerusalem. You've got the Dome of the Rock up here, and then there's on the platform where the temple used to be, and then the Western Wall is the outer retaining wall that's left from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 CE. You can pray there. Nobody bothers you. Right, Jews, Christians, the only thing they care about there is women over here and men over here. Men can make as much noise as they want, women shut up. If you have a woman on the men's side, then they go apoplectic. If they can hear a woman's voice, they go apoplectic. Because in their brand of Judaism, seeing a woman is tough enough, but hearing a woman, that is just beyond erotic, and they can't pray. They're too distracted. So, of course, that always makes me want to bring a tape recorder, with a woman's voice singing a Jewish prayer and just putting it on the... But I didn't. But we wanted to go in, and I invited the men. And I didn't go there to, turn over the carts of the money changers. That wasn't my goal. My goal was to try to see if all of us could have experiences at these different holy sites. So I invited all the men in the group to go on the men's side and see if they wanted to put on tefillin. Tefillin are phylacteries, the boxes that Orthodox Jews wear on their forehead and their arm near their heart, and they wrap it up on their hand. It's supposed to be a way of uniting your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions in service to the divine. So they were all freaked out. Nobody would do it. But there were a couple of Jewish guys on the trip, and they said, oh, they wanted to do it. So I walked in with them. I walked in with my friend Frank, and I walked in with this guy named Gary, all of whom look stereotypically Jewish. They're all New York Jews. And they walk in, and no one asked me anything. I went over, and I took a pair of tefillin, and I just did it. Frank walked over, and they said, can we help you? And then he said, yeah, that would be great. And so they helped him do it, too. Gary walks over, and they say, are you a Jew? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, prove it. Now, there's only one way to prove it. But that's not what they were asking, right? They wanted some kind of, who was your mother, and what was your mother's name, and what was your grandmother's name, what was your... So he's giving them all this information until they finally let him do it. But they were afraid, like the Muslim guys were afraid, of defiling the purity of their religion by letting a non-Jewish person do a Jewish thing. It just wasn't allowed. When we went to the tomb of Rachel, according to the Bible, Rachel dies giving birth to Benjamin, and Jacob buries her near Bethlehem. So we're in Palestine, near Bethlehem. There's that big, ugly dividing wall that the Israelis built is right by the tomb. And you can go in there. There's a men's side and the women's side. And there's a tomb there, supposedly. And everyone's praying. So we just went women went on one side, men went on the other side. And there we were completely ignored. You could do anything you want as long as the women didn't go on the men's side and no one could hear the women from the women's side. They ignored you. It was like you didn't exist. If you weren't one of them, you were just so inconsequential as to be invisible. It's just weird to me. But that's how it was. Now, we were there actually to do a ritual outside, and they didn't care what you did outside. There's a ritual called the Red Thread, where if you want to get pregnant, you go to Rachel's tomb. Supposedly, there's red thread that people have wrapped 7 times around the tomb, and then they sell you a piece of red thread. We got our red thread from Hobby Lobby, which already bothered me, you know, politically, but the woman who brought the thread said it was the best thread in Huntsville, Alabama, so that's why we got it. But we brought our own thread. She took it in the women's side. She touched it to the tomb, and then we came out, and we did this little exercise that I created around the red thread. Nothing to do with having babies. We had nuns with us. So we didn't want some virgin to have a baby. Even though she was Catholic, it probably wouldn't have worked well. They wouldn't have believed her. So we did a different ceremony. We took the prophet Micah chapter 6, verse 8, where Micah says, you know what God requires, do justly, love mercy, walk humbly. So we did this thing where you tie 3 knots and you make these commitments to yourself to live a life of justice, tie a knot. To live a life of compassion, you tie a knot. And to live a life of humility, you tie a knot. And then that was internal. And then you turn to someone in the group and you ask them to witness your commitment to justice, compassion, and humility. And they tie the string around your wrist. It was really very, very beautiful. 30 people in our group, we all did it. Even the guide did it, and even he was weeping. He'd never seen anything like that. That's what I was looking for the whole trip. But that only works when you're into religiosity and story as story, as opposed to being attached to religion and story as history. The only group I can think of that could bring that message to Israel are the Unitarians. So now that Carol Sue is healthy, because she's Jewish, she can just go there and they'll make her a citizen like that. And they'll bring Roger along and they can start this, I think, you know. But I think we need I don't know how you do it in the UU thing, but you need a little cadre of people who would go over there, not to live, just you could rotate through. But you set up a Unitarian office, something where this can happen, and it's just nowhere in Israel. It's sad that everyone is so locked into their silos that there's no dialogue between these different faiths. I mean, you're just happy if they're not shooting at one another, but there's no conversation, and there's no hope of getting to that deeper religiosity. So my second concern, is that there's no UU there. Now, I don't know how UU goes from place to place, but definitely this is something that I think you ought to consider. I looked it up online to see if someone's already done it. The only thing I could find is that the UUs are considering, or maybe they've already done it, the BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement against Israel. I'm ambivalent about that. I would do it against South Africa, so I don't see why I wouldn't do it against Israel. My only problem is BDS only focuses on Israel, not Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Iran and the United States, where all these horrendous things are happening as well, just against human rights. So I have an issue with that. But I really think, and I'm just going to end with this, and we can talk more about my trip later. I really think that the genius of the Unitarian Universalist Society, I never realized it was lacking in places. I mean, if you think about it, of course, there's probably no UUs in Iran, right? They'd kill you. But I never thought of it until I got there and realized how incredibly unique and special you all are and how desperately needed you are in Israel and other places. But Israel, you wouldn't get shot. Right? Well, I don't think you get shot. In Iran, you'd get shot. Saudi Arabia, you get shot. But in Israel, I don't think so. And if I'm wrong, you're dead, so what are you going to do? I apologize in advance. What am I going to do? But really, it's just, you might take this for granted, but when you go to a place that needs it so desperately, where I don't see any other future for the religions there, it really brings it home. So that's it for now, and we'll talk more about it during the talk back. Thank you.